This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Happy New Year from all of us at Science Friday. Hoping your 2013 will be a happy and a healthy one. This hour, we're going to look back at some of the big stories of 2012 and some that might not have made the front page of your local paper or your favorite blog, but were big stories as well. There are, of course, some obvious choices. The unique combination of events that made Sandy a superstorm and the engineering challenges that followed it. There was the discovery of the Higgs boson, maybe, or something like it. Or the growing influence of social media on our lives. We're ready to talk about it with our panel of journalists, and maybe there are some stories that flew under the radar, as I'm saying, and you think should have received more attention. What do you think? What do you think were the big stories of 2012, some that got undercovered? Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-TALK, 989-TALK, and as always, you can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Marietta Christina is editor-in-chief of Scientific American and senior vice president there. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Marietta.
Hey, thanks,
always
Ira. Great to be here.
Ivan Oransky is executive editor at Reuters Health. He's also co-founder of the Retraction blog. Thanks for coming back, Ivan.
Great to be here. Thank you.
The Retraction Watch blog, I should say.
Correct. And, I'm going to have to retract that now.
He just retracted.
We've had an instant retraction. Is that a record maybe for a retraction?
I think you've just said it.
But you see how effective this is.
It's true. I'm Mark Frohenfelder. He's co-founder of Boing Boing and editor-in-chief of Make Magazine on the phone with us from L.A. Thanks for joining us again, Mark.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Let me just start out the year by saying one story that did not get a lot of press, at least from, is a story that's recurring all the time, which is the space elevator. So that's something which we did not see a lot of.
But we did have a sky crane in Mars.
All right, Marianne, start off. Is that one of your picks, the sky
crane? That was one of this is the time of year, of course, you're looking back and you're saying, what are the themes? What are the things that sort of popped out at you? And, you know, you mentioned social media, Ira. We had several Twitter followers between the last couple of days telling us about what they were mm-hmm. thinking. And I was looking at all of these things and I was thinking, you know, science is such a human endeavor. So this year we probed from, you know, all the way out to Mars. We just mentioned that, the sky crane, which I'll get back to in a second, down to the foundations of the universe. You mentioned the Higgs boson, mm-hmm. all the way up to miles high in the atmosphere and all the way down miles below to mm-hmm. the bottom of the ocean. And I think we learned, also a lot more about what makes us tick and life in general. And I love, personally, the awe and wonder buttons that you could, you know, you, there's this row of invisible buttons in front of my shirt right now that nobody can see but me. And so some of the awe and wonder buttons are things like the amazing landing of the Mars Curiosity rover.
The crane.
Via sky crane through a series of things, right? There was this giant heat. Does everybody remember?
Seven minutes of terror? 7 minutes of terror.
You know, there was the and I remember watching that unfold both, you know, on Twitter and through the NASA live feed and mm-hmm. all these things. The heat shield, the supersonic parachute, and then finally the sky crane, that lowered this car-sized lab with 10 different science instruments to the ground. That was extraordinary. Mm. It was a complete blast.
If there was any way to follow that bouncing airbag last of the last rover, this is the way
this
to
is
do
the way
it.
To follow
this
it.
Is this is a, this is how you could top that. Ivan, what have you got on your list?
Well, to me, I mean, thinking about themes, Mariette and I were actually talking very briefly before we went on air here about this sort of and I think it keys back to what you just said about science being a uniquely human endeavor. The idea that, in fact, science is done by scientists and they are human beings, I think sometimes people don't like to admit that, or maybe they don't want to acknowledge it. But one of the things that came up a lot this year in particular fields, but I think overall in science, was this idea that maybe results don't always hold up as much as we'd like them to, this idea of reproducibility. Can you actually, if you repeat the experiment or do it in a different sample set or do it in a larger sample, that it doesn't actually hold up? There are a lot of people publishing work. They've been doing it for a couple of years, but I think this year, for some reason, it popped. And there's a woman, Elizabeth Irons, who actually came up with something called the Reproducibility Initiative. Mm-hmm. A little bit tongue-tied getting that one out, but really important and very early days. Let's not sort of say that it's successful yet. But this idea that, in fact, researchers can almost outsource the replicability, the reproducing of their own experiments to try and, you know, make sure the scientific record is more clean, is more self-correcting. I think that's sort of a big theme for this year.
Mm-hmm. Are things being retracted faster or quicker in their retraction?
It's funny. You know, you set the record just now in milliseconds, I think, Ira. We actually had a retraction record, a couple of retraction records this year. One was the person who is likely to retract the most papers ever. That's an anesthesiologist in Japan named Yoshitaka Fuji. He's likely to retract 172 papers. That's about 168 and a half more than I ever published. I don't know about you guys, but it's quite a lot. And again, it was because people actually found statistical problems in all the work. The other record that we set, though, was, we didn't set it, but that science set, was the longest time from paper published to retraction, which turned out to be 27 years and a month. A little bit different from what you'd like to see in science, but the number of retractions overall is about the same as it was last year, about 400, it looks like it'll be. Mm-hmm.
Marco Frohnfelder, what's on your list?
Well, I think the thing that really is interesting me about last year was, and this year, are the affordable and really powerful tools and technologies out there that are allowing things like citizen science and personal manufacturing on a level that we haven't seen before. And that's things like 3D printing, the Arduino electronic prototyping platform that's giving a lot of people the ability to create really cool, sophisticated electronics projects that normally would have required a degree in engineering, but now artists and designers and kids and anybody are able to make really cool things with these. I think things like the SafeCast project that was a joint project between a couple of hackerspaces, one in LA and one in Tokyo, to do radiation monitoring, to create this amazing, inexpensive radiation monitoring network around the world. They've collected 3.5 million data points so far. These kinds of things are really exciting and weren't possible just a few years ago.
1-800-989-8255. Somebody tweeted in that our calendars did not end on 12/21. 12 was a big story, and that is tech to be praised. You know, the debunking of what really the calendars were about and the Mayans, things like that. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see what other people are. We've got a few minutes before the break. Here's an interesting one that happened toward the end of the year. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi there.
There was a study. There was a story just out showing that fructose causes, with MRI studies, they were showing that fructose causes addictive patterns in the brain. And if you combine that with Nora Volkoff's work, where she's talking about addiction maybe is more biochemical brain rather than willpower. Do you have any thoughts on that? I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, thanks for calling. Ivan, do you remember that study?
I do remember that one vaguely. I have to admit that among the hundreds that I read every month, I certainly remember it, and I think the caller is remembering it accurately. I think that this is a year where people have started to, on the one hand, look at, okay, well, just because something, and I'm going to be very, very sort of, pop-sci here a little bit, and say just because something lights up in the brain doesn't mean it tells us anything. On the other hand, people have actually started refining techniques so that when I see someone like Nora Volkow, at NIAID come up with something, I say, hey, you know what, there's probably something here. And so this, I wouldn't say pendulum because that's not actually how science works, but the sort of progressive nature of learning about addiction as a disease versus what other people sort of think about it, I think is pretty important.
I think one of the themes, just to add really quickly to what Ivan is saying, is that one of the themes from science always is, we had this understanding, but it's actually more complicated than that, and I think this study is representative of that. There are many subtleties in an organ as complex as the brain, with a billion cells and a trillion neural connections, and no one factor is going to probably outweigh all the others, but a collective understanding of all of them will eventually lead us closer to a path where we can correct issues.
Absolutely.
I'd like to also say that Dr. Volkow is is a rising star in the scientists who will speak out about things. Vocal scientists who really will tell you the way they think it really is. And I might have been this year, might have been last year. She's been on the program so many times. And when we talked about, people asked, do cell phones cause any problems in your head? She didn't say no. She said, "We don't know." And I asked her, "Well, what do you do?" She says, I don't put it anywhere near my head." She was here's the head of one of the institutes. She says, "I don't put it anywhere near any part of my body. I have it on an earphone plug because I don't know enough, and I don't suggest anybody does that." You know, it was very refreshing to hear somebody come out.
I both like the candid answer and also the easy solution. Earplug.
Well, it was very funny because somebody said, "Well, why don't you put it in your pocket?" It was one of the and she says, "Do you know what's close to your pocket?"
Although I have heard wearing one of those wired earphones, the acts as an antenna, the wire, for emitting radiation too. So, who knows if that's safe?
Yeah. Well, that goes to the idea that science is basically following a moving target in research.
And what's going on. And the problem with life is none of us gets out alive. Yeah.
Well, and the precautionary principle, right? I mean, there's no reason to put the phone in a particular place. So why put it there?
There you go. Mark, online, was there a lot of activism online, at least in some circles?
Well, yeah, I think the big thing was the SOPA bill that the Senate counterpart was called PIPA. That was the goal to stop online piracy by blacklisting web domains that were suspected of piracy. And there was a huge protest online about this bill that was introduced on January 18th, a bunch of websites went dark that day, including Wikipedia, and Google collected 7 million signatures in a petition against it. It was a really dangerous piece of legislation because it would have given the government the power to block an entire domain just because a commenter posted a link to an entirely different website suspected of having infringing content. Mm-hmm. And so There were a lot of different problems with the bill. I think it was forcing search engines to delete domain names was a violation of the First Amendment. But because of this big protest that millions of people online participated in, the bill was shelved indefinitely.
All right, we're going to come back and talk a lot more about the highlights from 2012. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about 2012, the year in review in science. My guests are Marietta Christina, editor-in-chief at Scientific American, Ivan Oransky, executive editor at Reuters Health, and Mark Frohnfelder, editor-in-chief of Make Magazine, our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Alexandra in San Francisco. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was really excited when the Russians found that under Glacier Lake in the Antarctic that hadn't been exposed to any type of elements for 500,000 years or 500 million years, they were trying to drill down into it. I thought that was profoundly fascinating. What would it be like to be an organism and have your sky drilled into, after all those years?
It was a fascinating story. The fact that could... stuff could survive that long and where they found it and that they did get to it and what they found, yeah.
I think that's a great observation, and maybe that'll be a big 2013 story when we find out what is under there, because they're still digging along.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call.
I remember being I was in Antarctica years ago when they actually watched them drill into one of these lakes and watching them go scuba diving into this big hole. That was a scuba diver at the time, and I said, I'm not going down into that hole, which only had about four feet of water under it. The ice was so thick, but I think there was more in there. But it's quite exciting. Who knows what else there is lying around in Antarctica?
Yep.
Give us another pick on your list. How about medicine? Anything in medicine this year?
I think one of the things that I don't know if it has any direct, if you will, scientific or clinical application yet, but obviously I think the big story is the Affordable Care Act. Otherwise known even by many in the Obama administration now as Obamacare. Mm-hmm. They've sort of embraced that. How that's going to all play out is obviously unclear, and a lot of it isn't really going into effect until 2014. Some of it is coming online now. But, again, one of the things that I think to watch for is whether or not things like comparative effectiveness research, looking at comparing two different drugs or different surgeries or not doing anything at all, which is always an option in some cases, in many cases, whether or not that's going to be translated into whether doctors get paid more or other healthcare providers get paid more or less. A lot of doctors are obviously a little concerned. A lot of insurance companies are sort of saying they're concerned, but are actually quite happy. Again, not really a science story, but it's mm-hmm. a pretty big thing that we kind of can't ignore.
Mm-hmm. There is a tweet coming in from Jose Canario who says, "What about the science of fracking? What is safety versus advantage really in the process of fracking?" And it's amazing how fracking just exploded, so to speak, this year in the news. And in fact, I was watching a news story last night about a company that's going to export natural gas. We are now going to become a supplier. We have so much natural gas surplus that we're going to become a supplier. The U.S. is going to be an energy exporter of liquid natural gas. And who knows what kind of implications that has for health, for the environment, for all kinds of commerce.
This year, I think, was it today that I read that New York State said something about it was going to be okay to do fracking, or it's safe to do fracking? Is that?
They commissioned a study. They said that the study didn't find a problem with it. Okay. Now it's up to the governor and whom else.
I mean, here's a case where, you know, many times people say the science or the technology is neutral and it's up to society to determine how to use it. And here's a case where science has been following hot on the heels of what society is doing anyway to try to sort out whether this is safe to do, what are the risks, how can you mitigate them. There are various ways to do that. The technologies are improving all the time, although many people still have a lot of questions about fracking.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the phones. Go to Ryan in Nashville. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how's everything going up there?
Hey there.
I would like to nominate, maybe not as a highlight, but a lowlight, when a U.S. congressman, and I don't remember his name, stands in front of the Wall of Deer, and he sits on the science committee, and he says the Earth is only 9,000 years old. I think it points out that we got a lot of work to do.
I think that is a low light. I remember the quote,
right.
Science is lies from the pit of H-E double hockey stick, as my kids would call it. I think this is unfortunate that, in fact, the Board of Editors at Scientific American spent some time discussing whether we should have some kind of recommendation for minimal standards for congressional leaders to have if they want to serve on science committees.
Not to sort of put that together with making light of something which, you know, 9,000 years old, but they were quite serious sort of failure to understand science things that happened on congressional floor. Women who are raped can block, you know, fertilization. That, you know, this sort of, you know, that's where, and again, looking at it from a health point of view, this has a real impact. Even if it only distracts us from what we really should be looking at, that has a real impact.
Well, and here's something just to add really quickly to what you're saying, Ivan, because I think that's a great point. There are now set of common STEM or science, technology, engineering, medicine, learning standards up for consideration in various states around the country. Some states have adopted, some have not. All should adopt them so that people can learn about science from a young age, and then they can evaluate the evidence as it comes in. Right. And then they will understand what the difference is between 9,000 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you have another topic you'd like to throw in there.
One thing that I think is really interesting is the way that the price of gene sequencing has been dropping so fast. I think the first human genome cost around $3 billion to sequence about 10 or 12 years ago, and we're getting at the point where it's going to be about $1,000 and take like 15 to 20 minutes to sequence your genome, your personal genome. There are already cool services out there like 23andMe, and then programs you can get online that will analyze your 23andMe data to show you what kind of genetic predispositions you might have towards different kinds of food intolerances or things like that. So that is really exciting, the personal genomics movement that's happening.
That's going to be a big story this year, too, because personalized medicine, and what do you do with the data? Mm. What do you do with the knowledge? Do you want, if you don't want to know, what kind of...
That's true.
Or you don't want someone else to know.
Or someone, and what if your doctor knows, and you've been a patient your whole life? Is he under any ethical obligation to tell you, even if you don't want to know it? You know?
Employers, insurance companies, it goes on and on.
Well, I think we're still at a point where a lot of that information isn't necessarily useful. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't know it. It doesn't mean we should block it or pretend it doesn't exist. I think we just have to be very clear about what we can actually say. And some of the most advanced sort of personal genomics, personalized medicine is really about determining whether or not you will respond, say, to a particular kind of chemotherapy if you have breast cancer, or to another kind of drug, you know, based on what your liver, what kind of enzymes your liver likes to make. Those things are really important. Is it important to know whether or not you have a 19% or a 27% risk of getting a particular disease by the time you're 80? That's going to have to be up to everybody to mm-hmm. decide, but we can't paint these things as binary.
1-800-989-8255. Joey in Denton, Texas. Hi, Joey.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey there.
Yeah, I was just, first and foremost, thank you very much for the show. It's awesome.
You're welcome.
But it's more about the oldest galaxy that we've recently have found. It's about 200 million years after the Big Bang. And what, if any, implications that really has for the progression of science? And, I mean, is that really going to, you know, be able to finally, how far back can we actually reach and or see in doing this?
You know, it's so funny that you're talking about that. And wow, what a timely comment that is. Good for you. Because just this morning, right before I came here, in fact, I edited a piece which is now up on Scientific American's website about our top 10 list for space stories. And one of them was seeing some of the most remote objects that have ever been observed by instruments so far. And indeed, we are getting close to the edges of the observable universe. After that, the physics starts to get in the way of seeing further. And what does it mean? Well, we can get more clues about how the universe came to be in the state it is today. We can learn more about how things formed and how they evolved. And I talked to you guys about the awe and wonder buttons before. I mean, this really does it for me, this sort of thing. It's quite amazing to take an armchair journey with these researchers out to the edges of the known universe.
I also think it's exciting in totally the opposite direction of finding these exoplanets that are so close to us.
Yes, absolutely. The new one around, new one.
Bunch of them.
Recently discovered.
Yes, but to think that they are so close that we, if there was intelligent life, we could have a discussion in a lifetime, in one person's lifetime, a message going back and forth.
Right, because these are barely 4, light years more distant, and of course, radio waves travel at the speed of light as well.
Thanks, Joey. That's a good topic.
Great topic.
Have a happy New Year.
Yeah, you too.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see. Mariette, do you have something on one of your buttons lighting up?
You know what? One of my buttons has been waiting very patiently for a while now. Can we not have a conversation about 2012 and can we have a conversation and exclude the Higgs boson that you mentioned at the beginning of the show? We can't exclude this for a couple of reasons. For the folks who haven't, somehow maybe you haven't heard about this. This is, every field has an associated particle, and there's this field, the Higgs field, that is thought to by theoretical physicists to exist throughout the cosmos. It's kind of like, I'll think of it as the force only real. And it imbues certain particles with mass. And it has been for 30 years or so, a missing block of something called the Standard Model, which is our best explanation yet of particle modeling. And this year, at last, we found what looks like they call it a Higgs-like particle.
I think so.
Because if I could only to explain to you how hard it is to sort through these data decay
symbols. I got a half an hour.
Symbols.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. It's just, and how you have to race these protons. This is, of course, at the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. And racing these protons at high speeds and smashing them together. And then you hope you see the fleeting residue of a Higgs boson, because of course nobody can observe one quite directly. Mm-hmm. And then you pile on data after data after data result, and you hope you get a clear signal. And it's like, I think it's like your friend, physicist describe it like this. It's like your friend is in the distance and you're not quite sure yet. Is it your friend Ira? Mm. It's a guy with dark hair. He has
that's about that same build.
But then he comes a little closer and you begin to see that it is in fact Ira, or you begin to see that it is in fact a Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. And this is a capstone of the Standard Model, and it tells us another fantastic thing about how the universe works. And I think it's just amazing that humans can do things like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And And the kind of boson Higgs it was, not, you know.
Right, because.
Just a vanilla little Higgs.
Well, you know, that. Yeah. Without getting into giga electron volts too much, I can just say that, you know, the relative measure of this could mean one thing or another for whether there are new doors in physics that physicists can open after this discovery is finally wrestled to the ground.
Mariette, the most eloquent geek I know. Thank you for that.
My pleasure, Ira.
I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Here with Ivan Oransky, Mariette DeChristine, and Mark Rohnfelder. Mark, if you want, what about things that happen in the politics of the internet? And I'm talking about maybe Apple and Google and all that kind of stuff. What was the highlight of the year and the way they're fighting?
I think the continued effect of patent trollism, where people buy up patents that shouldn't have been granted in the first place, and then they start going after people and companies to try to collect back royalties from them, is a really dangerous precedent that we're seeing more of that. Just reading recently about some guy who, a company that's really hard to trace, who's actually doing it, but claiming to have a patent on scanner technology, and basically is trying to shake down every company that has ever made a scanner or individuals or companies that have used scanners. And this kind of thing has been going on for a long time. You remember when Amazon.com patented the one-click buy button,
right,
which was ridiculous and caused an uproar. And I believe they still were able to keep that patent. But this is coming to a head, and we are going to have to see some kind of action taken, because it's really – otherwise it's going to – stifle innovation online and in the internet, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this next coming year, especially with some recent court decisions that just came out this week, is going to be very interesting to see how this all shakes out and whether Apple can keep its dominant position, you know, in innovation. It'll be interesting to see.
Oh yeah, that's been a big. I think that's been a lot of people are talking about that. A lot of my friends who are journalists or analysts who are big Apple fans are thinking that their next phone might be the Galaxy S3 instead of the iPhone 5. It's an interesting.
And what interesting are the, what concerns, what is in the history now that concerns them, that the loss of Steve Jobs? And I think this might be a part of the story of the year. Is what has, we're now a year past the loss of Steve Jobs. Are we beginning to see, did we begin to see some of the fallout of his creativity and his vision, the lack of it?
I think it could be. I think that's definitely part of it. He probably had a few years of things in the pipeline being developed, but Apple, the stumble with their maps, which was a huge problem for them, really pointed the way towards them, you know, releasing something that was just awful. And I think their bad relationship with Google has caused problems for them too. So this other thing that you can look at it, another way to look at it is, though, that the other phone manufacturers and service providers have caught up now, and so we're going to see some healthy competition. And Apple is no longer going to be able to kind of rest on this fabulous reputation that it's had for the last decade.
Yeah, and we'll have to see what new toys come out by the spring, the summer. Will there be a mini this? Or there was talk this week about a mini iPhone to have a lower price point because their other competitors are $100 or more cheaper than what the iPhone.
Sure, and they also crank them out much faster. Samsung makes new handsets like every 3 months, and Apple, they're lucky if they get something out, once a year or year and a half. So that's hard for them. Are they going to have to change their mm-hmm. game and start cranking out stuff, new models every 3 months? That would be a huge change for them, and I don't know if they're up for that.
All right, we're going to come back and take lots more of your calls. 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. We're talking about the year in review and looking forward a little bit to 2013. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the year in review, or some of the big stories of 2013. One, I think, was having trouble answering how old the Earth was by some people. My guests are Mariette DeCristina of Scientific American, Ivan Oretsky of Reuters Health, Mark Frohnfelder of Make Magazine, our number 1-800-989-8255. Mariette, let's talk about some big ethics stories of the year, like the guy who was finding the guy about the algae bloom soaks up the CO2 trick.
Oh, you know, like, actually, let's back up for okay. 1 second, because I think that's a very interesting, that is an ethical issue. I think maybe 2012 might be the year that everybody finally woke up about the climate. And this is one expression of that.
There was a paradigm shift, maybe?
Well, I'm going to hope so. It's kind of hard to see when you're in the moment, but looking back, we had the record meltdown of Arctic sea ice this year, which has been, we've been losing Arctic sea ice since, for many years now. And since, I think we noticed it's around 2000, and it's been shrinking even faster since 2007. Mm-hmm. So we're just seeing that, maybe there are some human benefits of navigation and so on, but what's happening with that, and part of the reason why I think that so-called rogue experiment happened, was it's exposing a lot of darker ocean water, which is seemingly having a feedback effect on the climate mm-hmm. that models didn't anticipate necessarily, and could potentially be a factor in changing things faster even than we expected them to change.
Certainly that Greenland melting that they observed.
And certainly now scientists around 2012, it's hard to say exactly, but many people are stopping adding the caveat of, maybe this changes in climate can factor into a large storm like the Superstorm Sandy that we mm-hmm. experienced along the East Coast here, to saying that it has, because they can't see another reason. Storm Sandy got a big kick from the warmer than normal waters.
Right.
And then potentially, because of that Arctic sea melt, which has a way of shifting the jet stream that normally would occur, could have pushed the storm into making that left-hand turn, which storms are not supposed to make, and that was really odd. So maybe, I'm flipping it back to you a little bit, but rogue experiments that try to solve this just go to show how people have, of seeding the ocean with iron and so on, and trying to mm-hmm. create an algal bloom that can maybe soak up some carbon dioxide. Hopefully, you don't create, mm-hmm. An ocean dead zone mm-hmm. where that algae soaks up all the oxygen in the water, or have other impacts. But I think they're just a symptom of people finally realizing that all this climate talk is not a joke.
Yeah.
And it's not maybe gonna kind of happen in 10 years. It's happening now. And we're seeing the signs all around us.
It's quacking like a duck.
Yeah, it's quacking like a duck.
Speaking of quacking like a duck, let's go to Tim. Sorry, Tim. Tim in Chicago. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
I just wanted to suggest the H5N1 story. I believe that was the bird flu being shown to be transmissible from birds to mammals, as well as the NSADV's inability to deal with the results of that research. I think for me as a microbiologist, it's one of the biggest stories of the year.
Agree with you. I think that's a great observation. In fact, funny, last year's show, I remember we talked about this because at the time, the top journal editors in Nature and Science had held off on publication, and the publications finally happened this year.
Yeah, I was going to say that that whole ethical question, should they release the knowledge about how the virus works, so that there was a fear that somebody could come and make a virus.
Well, and it gets back to the dual use you were talking about earlier. I don't know if you used that term, but that's sort of consistent here, where you know, we're talking about something that could be used, obviously, in a very bad way, in a, whether it's terrorism or just some other way that could be bad. But on the other hand, we clearly want to understand it. So I think that's a mm-hmm. sort of key ethical issue. Mm-hmm.
We also had some very interesting people who passed away this year, scientists who passed away. Sherry Rowland, who was actually on the first Science Friday broadcast back in 1991, back there talking about something called an ozone hole and things like that.
And here's been a great success, actually. The ozone hole has shrunk because people listen to Sherry Rowland's research.
Yeah. Sally Ride, Neil Armstrong, and Rita Levi-Montalcini, recently, an Italian Nobel neurologist who passed away. So there have been some notable deaths. Interesting anniversaries. Also, I think we just had one this week. I'll throw it into last year. It was the 30th anniversary of the internet, of the public internet. The first time it was opened up about 30 years ago.
And I think, was it last year or think of 30th? Maybe around this time, first test tube baby. Or was that 1981? Was it 81 or 82? I don't remember. But she had her own baby, which was sort of a neat cycle.
That year, 81, was full of stuff.
Yep.
You know, his first shuttle launch was 81. I don't know why I'm trying to think of Dolly. The name Dolly jumps into my head. I don't know if Dolly the sheep was that. I don't remember what. No, she came later.
I think
later.
It was came early late. 90s, right?
Yeah, came later.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
Died, yeah.
Maybe it was the ice cream. Let's Mark, this seems to be a big – it's a problem with doing a talk show. You got all this stuff in your head, and you don't know what you're in camera, and you go out there and throw it out.
Especially
and
people
wrong.
Like us. We have a lot floating around in
what
our
do we
head.
Have for breakfast? I think that came up earlier.
And I didn't even know.
Mark, let's talk about the surge in crowdfunding of projects, the small donations from lots of people to get special things off the ground, right?
Oh, yeah, that was huge, and that's really been an exciting development because this kind of crowdfunding, like you see with Indiegogo and the big one now,
Kickstarter. Yeah,
Kickstarter. It's this interesting space where people who have a great idea to either create a book, make some kind of electronic gadget, fund a movie. If they can't do it out of their pocket and they don't have some well-heeled friends to do that for them, and the project is not that big that they are going to look for like venture capital or a large bank to supply them, they can go to these crowdfunding sites and get funding for their projects. And we've seen these examples of like the Pebble Watch, I think, got about $10 million in funding and these other multi-million-dollar ones. But I think the really interesting space is the one where it's between $5,000 and $25,000 to fund these kinds of projects that might never have seen the light of day because there wasn't a place for them. This is like a spot in the funding spectrum that didn't exist before at all.
Right.
So we're going to see things that people are creating that didn't exist before, that kind of things. And so it's this kind of disrupting technology that is, you know, one of my favorite things, enabling people to do things that they normally wouldn't have been able to do a few years ago.
Well, I mean, that's what I think, Mark, is so interesting about this, is that there was actually a science project, right, just last month that was funded, I want to say about $25,000. And it, you know, again, it just sort of grew on Twitter and on all the places you would expect. In terms of science journalism, in fact, we saw a Matter magazine was funded and overfunded. I don't want to claim, you know, they would be very angry
at me
for saying nothing's overfunded,
right.
But it exceeded their goal by quite a lot, and people do well there. So it's actually really interesting, and to me, it also gets back to, you know, in a sort of different way, the sort of the problems with some of our funding mechanisms and the fact that we have this winner-takes-all approach to getting grants and big money and
also,
all that.
Also, do I remember, maybe you gentlemen will remember better, some obscene amount of time that scientists typically spend on writing funding grant proposals.
Right.
It's a giant block. It might be a third of their time. It might be even a little bit more.
Yeah, I think PIs might spend even more.
Yeah, even more time, which is, if you think about trying to get the most science for the dollar, spending that much of a block of time just trying to acquire the dollars is really inefficient. And you can do a lot of great science for a few tens of thousands.
I'm reminded of the Tesla Museum that got funded by this.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, so you just kind of posit something interesting, make a compelling enough video, and you'll get people who want to see this happen. I would love to see some people do some research about the psychology of funding these things and find out where this generosity is coming from. It's inspiring and pretty surprising.
When you said psychology and people getting to do things, it reminded me of something new that happened during the election this year, last year's election, that you could actually go out using scientific methods and persuade people to vote, right? Is by using there's a whole book. The books have been written about this, that the Obama campaign hired the people, wrote the books, to find out how to persuade the voters in the key states to get them actually out to the poll using psychology. And I think that's a real breakthrough.
And how about all the mathematical analyses
Nate Silver.
Nate Silver.
538.
Yeah. I love that.
But, you know, when you bring up psychology, Ira, I thought you might have been going in the other direction, which is unfortunate, which is that social psychology, sort of a lot of real problems were exposed in that field this year. A tremendous amount of fraud, particularly in the Netherlands. Diederik Stapel is the name that comes to mind. Had to retract 31 papers, may have to retract many more. And social psychology, to its credit, the field has really taken it upon themselves and said, you know, we've got an issue. But that was a big deal to a lot of people.
Let me get one call in from Susan in Louisville. Hi, Susan.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention the meningitis from the epidural steroid injections.
Do you think that was undercovered?
Maybe. It seems like a lot of people died, and it just seems like that shouldn't be happening now.
Well, I think that we're going to sort of see the hands. I think that's an excellent thing to bring up. Again, not a positive story. One hopes that something positive can come out of that in terms of oversight and what have you. I think we're going to see the hangover of that. We're still seeing it, actually. There are more cases being described and discovered. But I think in terms of the FDA, and I know Congress is going to look at whether or not they could do more to regulate compounding pharmacies.
All right. Thanks for calling, Susan. Have a happy new year.
Thanks. You too.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.